Osho, Returning to the Source, Talks on Zen, given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India. Discourse number 5.
Bhagwan, the Prime Minister, Kyo Tse-i, of the Tang Dynasty, was an outstanding statesman, a distinguished general, and the most admired national hero of his day. But fame, power, wealth and success could not distract him from his keen interest and devotion to Buddhism. Regarding himself as a plain and humble devoted Buddhist, he often visited his favorite Zen master to study under him. He and the Zen master seemed to get along very well. The fact that he was the Prime Minister seemed to have no influence on their association. There was no noticeable trace of politeness on the Zen master's part, or of vain loftiness on the part of the minister. The association seemed to be the purely religious one of a revered master and obedient disciple. One day, however, when he was paying his usual visit to the Zen master, he asked the following question: "Your Reverence, how does Buddhism explain egotism?" The Zen master's face suddenly turned blue, and in an extremely haughty and contemptuous manner, he said to the Premier, "What are you saying, you numbskull?" This unreasonable and unexpected defiance so hurt the feelings of the Prime Minister that a slight, sullen expression of anger began to show on his face. The Zen master then smiled and said, "Your Excellency, this is egotism."
Ego is the basic problem, the most basic. And unless you solve it, nothing is solved. Unless ego disappears, the ultimate cannot penetrate you. The ego is like a closed door. The guest is standing outside. The guest has been knocking, but the door is closed. Not only the door is closed, but the ego goes on interpreting. It says, there is nobody outside. No guest has come. Nobody has knocked. Just a strong wind is knocking at the door. It goes on interpreting from the inside without looking at the fact. And the door remains closed. By interpretations, even the possibility of its opening becomes less and less. And a moment comes, you are completely closed in your own ego. Then all sensitivity is lost. Then you are not an opening, and you cannot have a meeting with existence. Then you are almost dead. The ego becomes your grave. This is the most basic problem. If you solve it, everything is solved. There is no need to seek God. There is no need to seek truth. If the ego is not there, everything is found suddenly. If the ego is not there, you simply come to know that truth has always been around you, without and within. It was the ego which won't allow you to see it. It was the ego that was closing your eyes and your being. So the first thing to be understood is what this ego is. A child is born. A child is born without any knowledge, any consciousness of his own self. And when a child is born, the first thing he becomes aware is not he. The first thing he becomes aware is the others. It is natural, because the eyes open outwards, the hands touch others, the ears listen others, the tongue tastes the food, and the nose smells outside. All these senses open outwards. That is what birth means. Birth means coming into this world, the world of the outside. So when a child is born, he is born into this world. He opens his eyes, sees others. Other means the Tao. He becomes aware of the mother first. He becomes aware of his own body. That too is the other. That too belongs to the world. He is hungry and he feels the body. His need is satisfied, he forgets the body. This is how a child grows. First he becomes aware of you, thou, the other. And then by and by, in contrast to you, thou, he becomes aware of himself. This awareness is a reflected awareness. He is not aware who he is. He is simply aware of the mother and what she thinks about him. If she smiles, if she appreciates the child, if she says you are beautiful, if she hugs and kisses, the child feels good about himself. Now a ego is born through appreciation, love, care. He feels he is good. He feels he is valuable. He feels he has some significance. A center is born, but this center is a reflected center. It is not his real being. He does not know who he is. He simply knows what others think about him. And this is the ego, the reflection. What others think. If nobody thinks that he is of any use, nobody appreciates, nobody smiles, then too an ego is born, an ill ego. Sad, rejected, like a wound, feeling inferior, worthless. This too is the ego, this too is a reflection. If the mother, and mother means the world in the beginning, then others will join the mother and the world goes on growing. And the more the world grows, more complex becomes the ego, because many others' opinion are reflected. The ego is an accumulated phenomena, a byproduct of living with others. If a child lives totally alone, he will never come to grow an ego. But that is not going to help. He will remain like an animal. That doesn't mean that he will come to know the real self. No. The real can be known only through the false. So ego is a must. One has to pass through it. It is a discipline. The real can be known only through the illusion. You cannot know the truth directly. First, you have to know that which is not true. Well, first, you have to encounter the untrue. Through that encounter, you become capable of knowing the truth. If you know the false as the false, truth will dawn upon you. Ego is a need. It is a social need. It is a social byproduct. The society means all that is around you, except you, all that is around you. All minus you is the society. And everybody reflects. You will go to the school and the teacher will reflect who you are. And you will be in friendship with other children and they will reflect who you are. And by everybody is adding to your ego. And everybody is trying to modify it in such a way that you don't become a problem to the society. They are not concerned with you. They are concerned with the society. Society is concerned with itself, and that's how it should be. They are not concerned that you should become a self-knower. They are concerned that you should become an efficient part in the mechanism of the society. In the pattern you should fit. So they are trying to give you an ego that fits with the society. They teach you morality. Morality means giving you an ego which will fit with the society. If you are immoral, you will always be somewhere or other unfit. That's why we put criminals in the prisons. Not that they have done something wrong. Not that by putting them in the prisons we are going to improve them. No. Simply, they don't fit. They are troublemakers. They have certain types of egos which the society doesn't approve. If the society approves, everything is good. One man kills somebody. He is a murderer. And the same man in a war time kills thousands. He becomes a great hero. The society is not bothered by a murder, but the murder should be done for the society, then it is okay. The society doesn't bother about morality. The morality means only that you should fit with the society. If the society is in war, then the morality changes. If the society is in peace, then there is a different morality. Morality is a social politics. It is diplomacy. And each child has to be brought in such a way that he fits in the society. That's all. Because society is interested in efficient members. Society is not interested that you should attain to self-knowledge. Society is always against religion. Hence the crucifixion of Jesus, murder of Socrates, because they also don't fit. Two types of people don't fit. One who has developed the antisocial ego, he will never fit. But he also can be tried. There is a possibility. You can torture that man. You can punish. And he may come to his senses. The torture may be too much. And he may be converted. Then there is another type of man which is impossible for the society, a Jesus. He is not a criminal. But he has no ego. How can you make a man fit who has no ego? He looks absolutely irresponsible. He is not. But he has a greater commitment with God. he has no commitment with the society. One who is committed to God doesn't bother. He has a different depth of his morality. It doesn't come from codes. It comes from his self-knowledge. But then the problem arises. Because societies have created their moral codes. Those moral codes are man-made. Whenever a Jesus or a Buddha happens, he doesn't bother about the man-made conventions. He has a greater commitment. He is involved with the whole. And each moment, he decides his response through his awareness, not through conditioning. So nobody knows about him, what he will do. He is unpredictable. Societies can forgive criminals, but they cannot forgive Jesus and Socrates. That's impossible. And these people are almost impossible. You cannot do anything because they are not wrong. And if you try to understand them, they will convert you. Not that you can convert them. So it is better to kill them immediately. The moment the society becomes aware, it kills them immediately. Because if you listen to them, there is danger. If you listen to them, you will be converted. And there is no possibility to convert them. So it is better to finish. It is better to be completely have no relationship with them. You cannot put them in prisons because there also they will remain in relationship with the society. They will exist. Just their existence is too much. They have to be murdered. And then when priests take over, then there is no problem. Pope of the Vatican is part of the society. Jesus was never. That's the difference between a sect and a religion. A religion is never part of any society. It is universal. It is existential and very, very dangerous. You cannot find a more dangerous man than a religious man. More rebellious than a religious man, more revolutionary than a religious man. Because his revolution is so absolute, there is no possibility for any compromise with him. And he is so absolutely certain, because he knows what he is doing, that you cannot convert him. And he is infectious. If he is there, he will spread like a disease, infect many people. Jesus has to be killed. Christianity can be accepted, but not Christ. What is Christianity? Christianity is society's effort to replace Christ. Christ is dangerous. Society creates a Christianity around it. The Christianity is okay because it is a social phenomena, a social politics. The church is okay. The priest is okay. The prophet is dangerous. That's why there exist 300 religions on the earth. How can there be 300 religions? Science is one. You cannot have a Catholic science and a Protestant science. You cannot have a Mohammedan science and a Hindu science. Science is one. How can religion be 300? Truth cannot be sectarian. Truth is one and universal. Only one religion exists. Buddha belongs to that religion. Jesus belongs to that religion. Krishna, Muhammad, they all belong to that religion. And then there are 300 religions. These are false religions. These are tricks the society has played with you. These are substitutes, imitations. Look, Jesus is crucified on the cross. And what Vatican, the Pope of the Vatican is doing? He has a gold cross around his neck. Jesus is hanged on the cross. And on Vatican's neck, the cross is hanging. And it is a gold cross. Jesus had to carry his own cross. That cross was not golden. How crosses can be golden? That was very, very heavy. He had fallen while carrying it on the hillock of Golgotha. Under the weight, he had fallen. He had fainted. Have you seen any priest fainting under the weight of the golden cross? No, it is a false substitute. It is a trick. Now, this is no more religion. This is part of the social politics. Christianity is politics. Hinduism is politics. Buddhism is politics. Buddha, Jesus, Krishna, they are not social at all. They are not antisocial. They are beyond society. So there are two dangers for society: antisocial people, criminals. You can tackle them. They may be dangerous, but something can be done about them. They are not that dangerous. Then there is a group of people who are beyond society. They are impossible. You cannot change them. They will not be ready to make any compromise. The society creates an ego because the ego can be controlled and manipulated. The self never can be controlled and manipulated. Nobody has ever heard that the society can control itself. Not possible. And a child needs a center, and the child is completely unaware of his own center. The society gives a center. And the child is by and by convinced that this is your center. The ego that society gives. A child comes back to his home. If he has come first in his class, the whole family is happy. You hug and kiss, and you take the child and your soldiers, and you dance, and you say, "How a beautiful child. You are a pride to us." And you are giving an ego, a subtle ego. And if the child comes dejected, unsuccessful, a failure, he couldn't pass, or he has been just at the back bench, nobody appreciates, the child feels rejected, he will try hard next time because the center feels shaken. Ego is always shaken, always in search of food somebody should appreciate. That's why you continuously ask for attention. If the husband comes in the room and doesn't look at the wife, the trouble is there. If he is more interested in his newspaper, the trouble is there. How you dare to be more interested in the newspaper when the wife is there? That's why it has been always the misery. If a man is very, very great, then the wife is always a trouble. Otherwise will also be so. If a wife is very, very great, the husband will be a trouble. You ask the wives of great men, Because a great man has many deeper things to do. As Socrates, he was more interested in meditation than his wife, and that was a wound. Socrates' wife was continuously nagging. He was more attentive to somewhere else. Something more important than me? This shakes the ego. I have heard Mullah Nasruddin and his wife were coming out from a cocktail party. And Mullah said, "Darling, has anybody ever said to you how fascinating, how beautiful, how wonderful you are?" The wife felt very, very good, was very happy, and he said, "I think, why, nobody ever told me this." Then Nasruddin said, "Then from where you did get the idea?" "You get the idea from others, who you are. It is not a direct experience. It is from others you get the idea who you are. They shape your center. This center is false. Because you carry your real center, that is nobody's business. Nobody shapes it. You come with it. You are born with it. So you have two centers. One center you come with, which is given by existence itself, that is the self. And another center that is created by the society is the ego. It is a false thing. And it is a very great trick. Through the ego, the society is controlling you. You have to behave in a certain way, because only then the society appreciates. You have to walk in a certain way. You have to laugh in a certain way. You have to follow certain manners, morality, code. Only then the society will appreciate you. Otherwise, your ego will be shaken. And when the ego is shaken, you don't know where you are, who you are. The others have given you the idea. That idea is the ego. Try to understand it as deeply as possible. Because this has to be thrown. And unless you throw it, you will never be able to attain to the self. Because you are addicted with this center, then you cannot move and cannot look at the self. And remember, there is going to be an interval, when the ego will be settled, when you will not know who you are, when you will not know where you are going, when all boundaries will melt. You will be simply confused, a chaos. Because of this chaos, you are afraid to lose the ego. But that has to be so. One has to pass through the chaos before one attains to the real center. And if you are daring, the period will be small. If you are afraid, and again you fall back to the ego and again start arranging it, then it can be very, very long. Many lives can be wasted. Enlightenment is always sudden. There is nothing like gradual enlightenment. The gradualness comes if you are not daring. It comes out of your fears. Then you take one step towards the center, the real center, then you become afraid. You come back. It is just like a small child standing on the door, thinking to go, but there is dark. He looks out, comes back, again gathers a little courage, again looks. I have heard one small child was visiting his grandparents, just 4 years old. In the night, when the grandmother was making him to sleep, he suddenly started crying and weeping and said, "I want to go home. I am afraid of darkness." But the grandmother said, "I know well that at home also you sleep in dark. I have never seen light on. So why you are afraid here?" The boy said, "Yes, that's right. But that is my dark. This dark is completely unknown. Even with darkness, you feel this is mine. Outside, an unknown darkness. With the ego, you feel this is my dark. Maybe troublesome. Maybe it creates many miseries, but it's still mine. Something to hold to. Something to cling to. Something underneath feet. You are not in a vacuum, not in an emptiness. You may be miserable, but at least you are. Even being miserable gives you a feeling that I am. Moving from it, fear takes over. You start feeling afraid of the unknown darkness and chaos, because society has managed. It has cleared a small part of your being. It is just like you go to a forest. You make a little clearance. You clear a little ground. You make fencing. You make a small hut. You make a small garden, a lawn, and you are okay. Beyond your fence, the forest, the wild. Here everything is okay. You have planned everything. This is how it has happened. Society has made a little clearance in your consciousness. Just a little part. It has cleaned completely, fenced it. Everything is okay there. That's what all your universities are doing. The whole culture and conditioning is just to clear a part so you can feel at home there, and then you become afraid. Beyond the fence is danger. Beyond the fence, you are. As within the fence you are. And your consciousness is just one part. 1/10 of your whole being. 9/10 is waiting in the darkness. And in that 9/10, somewhere is hidden your real center. One has to be daring, courageous. One has to take a step into the unknown. For a while, all boundaries will be lost. For a while, you will feel dizzy. For a while, you will feel very much afraid and shaken, as if an earthquake has happened. But if you are courageous and you don't go backwards, you don't fall back to the ego, and you go on and on, there is a hidden center within you that you have been carrying for many lives. That is your soul, the Atma, the Self. Once you come near it, everything changes, everything settles again. But now this settling is not done by the society. Now everything becomes a cosmos, not chaos. A new order arises, but this is no more the order of the society. It is the very order of existence itself. That is what Buddha calls Dhamma. Lao Tse calls Tao. Heraclitus calls Logos. That is not man-made. It is the very order of existence itself. Then everything is suddenly beautiful again. And for the first time, really beautiful. Because man-made things cannot be beautiful. You can hide at the most the ugliness of them, that's all. You can decorate, but they can never be beautiful. The difference is just like the difference between a real flower and a plastic or a paper flower. The ego is a plastic flower, dead. Just looks like a flower, it is not a flower. You cannot really call it a flower. Even linguistically to call it a flower is wrong, because a flower is one who flowers. And this plastic thing is a thing, not a flowering. It is dead. There is no life in it. You have a flowering center within. That's why Hindus call it a lotus. It is a flowering. 1,000 petaled lotus, they call it. 1,000 means infinite petals. And it goes on flowering. It never stops. It never dies. But you are satisfied with a plastic ego. There are some reasons why you are satisfied. With a dead thing, there are many conveniences. One thing, a dead thing never dies. It cannot. It was never alive. So you can have plastic flowers. They are good in a way. They are permanent. They are not eternal, but they are permanent. The real flower outside in the garden is eternal but not permanent. And the eternal has its own way. How to be eternal? The way of the eternity is to be born again and again and to die. Through death it refreshes itself, rejuvenates itself. To us it appears that the real flower has died. It never dies. It simply changes the body. So it is ever fresh. The old body, it lives. It enters a new body. It flowers somewhere else. It goes on flowering. Because we cannot see the continuity, because the continuity is invisible. We see only one flower, another flower. We never see the continuity. It is the same flower which flowered yesterday. It is the same sun, but in a different garb. You need very penetrating eyes to see the invisible continuity. The invisible continuity is God. If you can see, this is the same flower in a different body. That's what Hindus call the theory of reincarnation. Christianity, Jewish religion, Mohammedanism, they all missed the beauty of it. So all the three religions by and by became materialists. They had to, because the invisible has been missed. I am here. You are here. You have been here millions of times before. It is an eternal recurrence, but in different bodies, different shapes. But the continuity is the same, and we call that continuity the soul. Not this body, forms change, the formless. It remains. And this is the way for it to be eternal, otherwise it cannot be eternal. Death is a way to rejuvenate oneself again. You exhale, this is the way to inhale again. You die, this is the way to be reborn. Each moment you die, the body is doing the same. You ask the physiologists, they say the body dies every moment and renews. Every cell will die. If you live 70 years, then for 10 times at least, the body would have died completely. But gradually it changes. One cell dies, another is replaced. It goes on. Leaves fall down. Just a few days before, the almond tree outside became completely naked. all the leaves fell down. This is the way. Now it is young again. Now new leaves have come. The old have gone. The new leaves have come. But leaves are not the tree. The tree is that source from which leaves come. And that source is hidden. The old drop so that the new can come. The old body dies so that the new body can come. This is how existence exists eternally. Always dying, always coming back. It is a wheel. The spokes go up, then they go down. This is the way how the wheel moves. The ego is a plastic thing. It looks permanent. Remember, eternity is not permanence. Eternity moves through movements. Eternity moves through change. Eternity is continuous change and yet remaining the same. Changing, yet remaining the same. Moving, yet never moving. The ego has a certain quality. It is dead. It is a plastic thing. And it is very easy to get it because others give it. You need not seek it. There is no search involved. That's why unless you become a seeker for the unknown, you have not yet become an individual. You are just a part of the crowd. You are just mob. When you don't have a real center, how can you be an individual? The ego is not individual. Ego is a social phenomenon. It is society. It is not you. But it gives you a function in the society, a hierarchy in the society. And if you remain satisfied with it, you will miss the whole opportunity of finding the self. And that's why you are so miserable. With a plastic life, how you can be happy? With a false life, how you can be ecstatic and blissful? And then this ego creates many miseries. Millions of them. You cannot see because it is your own dark. You are attuned to it. Have you ever watched that all types of miseries enter through the ego? It cannot make you blissful. It can only make you miserable. Ego is hell. Whenever you suffer, just try to watch and analyze, and you will find somewhere the ego is the cause of it. And the ego goes on finding causes to suffer. I was staying at Mullah Nasruddin's house once. The wife was saying very nasty things about Mullah Nasruddin. Very angry, rude, aggressive. Just on the verge to explode. Very violent. And Mullah Nasruddin was just sitting silently and listening. Then suddenly she turned towards him and said, "So again, you are arguing with me." Mullah simply said, "But I have not even said a single word." The wife said, "But you are, that I know. But you are listening very aggressively." If you are an egotist, and as everyone is, some are very grass just on the surface, and they are not more difficult. Some are very subtle, deep down, and they are the real problems. This ego comes continuously in conflict with others, because every ego is so unconfident about itself. Has to be, it is a false thing. When you don't have anything in your hand and you just think that something is there, then there will be a problem. If somebody says there is nothing, immediately the fight will start, because you also feel there is nothing. And the other makes you aware of the fact. Ego is false. It is nothing. That you also know. How can you miss to know it? It is impossible. A conscious being, how he can miss to know that this ego is just false? And then others say that there is nothing. And whenever the others say there is nothing, they hit a wound. They say a truth, and nothing hits like truth. And you have to defend, because if you don't defend, if you don't become defensive, then where you will be? You will be lost. The identity will be broken. So you have to defend and fight. That is the class. A man who attains to the self is never in any class. Others may come and class with him, but he is never in class with anybody. It happened, one Zen master was passing through a street. A man came running and hit him hard. The master fell down. Then he got up and started to walk in the same direction in which he was going before, not even looking back. Who is this man? A disciple was with the master. He was simply shocked. He said, "What is this? If one lives in such a way, then anybody can come and kill you. And you have not even looked at that person. Who is and why he did it?" The master said, "That is his problem, not mine." You can class with an enlightened man, but that's your problem, not his. And if you are hurt in that class, it is too your own problem. He cannot hurt you. But it is knocking against a wall. You will be hurt. But the wall has not hurt you. The ego is always looking for some trouble. Why? Because if nobody pays attention to you, the ego feels hungry. It lives on attention. So even if somebody is fighting and angry with you, that too is good, because at least the attention is paid. If somebody loves, it is okay. If somebody is not loving you, then even anger will be good. At least the attention will come to you. But if nobody is paying any attention to you, nobody thinks you are somebody important, significant, then how you will feed your ego? Others' attention is needed. In millions of ways, you attract attention of others. You dress in a certain way. You try to look beautiful. You behave. You become very polite. You change. When you feel what type of situation is there, you immediately change so that people pay attention to you. This is a deep begging. A real beggar is one who asks and demands attention. And the real emperor is one who lives in himself. He has a center of his own. He doesn't depend on anybody else. Buddha sitting under his Bodhi tree, if the whole world suddenly disappears, will it make any difference to Buddha? Nothing. It will not make any difference at all. The whole world disappears, it will not make any difference because he has attained to the center. But you, if the wife escapes, divorces you, goes to somebody else, you are completely shattered because she was paying attention to you, caring, loving, moving around you, helping you to feel that you are somebody. The whole empire is lost. You are simply shattered. You start thinking about suicide. Why? Why, if a wife leaves, you should commit suicide? Why, if a husband leaves, you should commit suicide? Because you don't have any center of your own. The wife was giving the center, the husband was giving the center to you. This is how people exist. That's how people become dependent on others. It is a deep slavery. Ego has to be a slave. It depends on others. And only a person who has no ego is for the first time a master. He is no more a slave. Try to understand this. And start looking for the ego, not in others, that is not your business, in yourself. Whenever you feel miserable, immediately close your eyes and try to find out from where the misery is coming, and you will always find this is the false center which has come in clash with someone. You expected something and it didn't happen. You expected something and just the contrary happened. Your ego is shaken. You are in misery. Just look, whenever you are miserable, try to find out. Causes are not outside you. The basic cause is within you. But you always look outside. You always look, who is making me miserable? Who is the cause of my anger? Who is the cause of my anguish? And if you look outside, you will miss. Just close the eyes and always look within. The source of all misery, anger, anguish is hidden in you, your ego. And if you find the source, it will be easy to move beyond it. If you can see that it is your own ego that gives you trouble, you would like to drop it. Because nobody can carry the source of misery if one understands it. And remember, there is no need to drop the ego. You cannot drop it. If you try to drop it, you will attain to a certain subtle ego again, that I have become humble. Don't try to be humble. That's again ego hiding. But it is not dead. Don't try to be humble. Nobody can try humility. And nobody can create humility through any effort of his own. No. When the ego is no more, a humbleness comes to you. It is not a creation. It is a shadow of the real center. And a really humble man is neither humble nor egoist. He is simply simple. He is not even aware that he is humble. If you are aware that you are humble, the ego is there. Look at humble persons. There are millions who think they are very humble. They bow down very low. But watch them. They are the subtlest egoists. Now, humility is their source of food. They say, I am humble. And then they look at you, they wait that you should appreciate that really you are humble. They would like you to say that in fact you are the most humble man in the world. Nobody is as humble as you are. Then see the smile that comes on their face. What is ego? Ego is a hierarchy that no one is like me. It can feed on humbleness. Nobody is like me. I am the most humble man. Once it happened, a monk came to me and he was talking about his humility. And I said, "You are nothing. I know a man who is more humble than you." Sudden anger, ego. And he said, "Who is that man? Show it to me." That is not the point. That is not the point. I am not going to show him to you. But try to understand, because suddenly the ego comes in. How somebody else is daring to be more humble than me? It happened once. A fakir, a beggar, was praying in a mosque. Just early in the morning when it was still dark. It was a certain religious day for Mohammedans. And he was praying and he was saying that I am nobody. I am the poorest in poor. The greatest sinner in sinners. Suddenly, there was one more person who was praying. He was the emperor of that country. And he was not aware that there is somebody else who is praying. It was dark. And the emperor was also saying that I am nobody. I am nothing. I am just empty. A beggar at your door. When he heard that somebody else is saying the same thing, he says, "Stop! Who is trying to overtake me? Who are you? How you dare to say before the emperor that you are nobody when he is saying I am nobody?" This is how the ego goes. It is so subtle. And its ways are so subtle and cunning. You have to be very, very alert only then. Don't try to be humble. Just try to look that the all misery, all anguish comes through it. Just watch. No need to drop it. You cannot drop it. Who will drop it? Then the dropper will become the ego. It always goes back. Whatsoever you do, it stands out of it and looks and watches. Whatsoever you do, humbleness, humility, simplicity, nothing will help. Only one thing is possible, and that is just to watch that it is the source of all misery. Don't say, don't repeat, watch. Because if I say it is the source of all misery and you repeat, it is useless. You have to come to the understanding. Whenever you are miserable, just close the eyes and don't try to find some cause outside. Try to look from where this misery is coming. It is your own ego. If you continuously feel and understand, and the understanding becomes so deep rooted that the ego is the cause, one day you will suddenly say, it has disappeared. Nobody drops it. Nobody can drop it. You simply see it has simply disappeared, because the very understanding that ego causes all misery becomes the dropping. The very understanding is the disappearance of the ego. And you are so clever in seeing the ego in others. Anybody can see anybody else's ego. When it comes to your own, then the problem arises. Because you don't know the territory. You have never traveled on it. The whole path towards the divine, the ultimate, has to pass through through this territory of the ego. The false has to be understood as false. The source of misery has to be understood as the source of misery. Then simply it drops. When you know it is poison, it drops. When you know it is fire, it drops. When you know this is the hell, it drops. And then you never say that I have dropped the ego. Then you simply laugh at the whole thing, the joke, that I was the creator of all misery. I was just looking at few cartoons on Charlie Brown. In one cartoon, he is playing with blocks, making a house out of children's blocks. He is sitting in between the blocks and raises the walls. Then a moment comes when he is enclosed. All around he has made a wall. Then he cries, "Help! Help!" He has done the whole thing. Now he is enclosed, imprisoned. This is childish, but this is all that you have done also. You have made a house all around you. Now you are crying, "Help! Help!" And the misery becomes millionfold, because there are our helpers also who are in the same boat. It happened, one very beautiful woman went to see her psychiatrist for the first time. The psychiatrist said, "Come closer, please." When she came closer, he simply jumped, hugged the woman, she was shocked, kissed her, then said, "Now sit down. This takes care of my problem. Now what is your problem?" The problem becomes multifold, because there are helpers who are in the same boat. And they would like to help, because when you help somebody, the ego feels very good. Very, very good, that you are a great helper, a great guru, a master, that you are helping so many people. Greater the crowd of your followers, the more better you feel. But you are in the same boat. You cannot help. Rather, you will harm. People who have still their own problems cannot be of much help. Only someone can help you who has no problems of his own. Only then he has the clarity to see. See through. A mind who has no problems of his own can see you. You become transparent. A mind who has no problems of his own can see through himself. That's why he becomes capable to see through others. In the West, there are many schools of psychoanalysis. Many schools. And no help is reaching to people, rather harm. Because the people who are helping others, are trying to help, are posing that they are helping, are in the same boat. I was reading William Reck's wife's memoirs. And he was one of the most significant psychoanalysts, one of the most revolutionary. But when the question comes to one's own problems, then the difficulty arises. The wife has written in her memoirs that he was teaching to others, don't be jealous. Love is not a possession, it is freedom. But about his own wife, he was always jealous. If she would laugh with someone, there was misery immediately. And he was making love to many women. And he will not allow his own wife even to smile with someone, even to be just sit, talk, he won't allow. And whenever he will go out, sometimes he had to go to see his patients, and the first thing he will do, he will come home and inquire where the wife has gone, to whom she has met, who has come to the house, and there will be a cross examination. The wife says she was simply surprised. This man is so wise with others, but with his own, it is difficult to see one's own ego. It is very easy to see others' egos, but that is not the point. You cannot help them. Try to see your own ego. Just watch it. Don't be in a hurry to drop it. Just watch it. The more you watch, the more you will become capable. Suddenly, one day you simply see it has dropped. And when it drops by itself, only then it drops. There is no other way. Premature, you cannot drop it. It drops just like a dead leaf. The tree is not doing anything. Just a breeze, a situation. And the dead leaf simply drops. And the tree is not even aware that the dead leaf has dropped. It makes no noise. It makes no claim. Nothing. Simply the dead leaf drops and settles on the ground. Just like that, when you are mature through understanding, awareness, and you have felt it totally that this is the cause of all my misery, simply, one day you see the dead leaf dropping. It settles into the ground, dies on its own accord. You have not done anything. So you cannot claim that I have dropped it. You simply see it has disappeared. And then the real center arises. And that real center is the soul, the self, the God, the truth, or whatsoever you want to call it. It is nameless. So all names are good, any name you can give it to it, of your own liking. Now listen to this beautiful story. The Prime Minister Kuotaze of the Tang Dynasty was an outstanding statesman, a distinguished general, and the most admired national hero of his day. Remember, when you are at the peak, it is very easy to be humble. I will repeat it. When you are successful, when you have come to the peak, it is very easy to be humble. When you are nowhere in the hierarchy, it is very difficult to be humble. A poor man finds it more difficult to be humble than a rich man. A politician who is defeated finds it more difficult to be humble than the politician who has won. Look at the top people in the world. They are always humble. They can afford. Now there is no danger to their ego. They have already attained. They don't bother about your attention. You don't mean anything to them. Now they have attained. They can be humble, they can afford. That's why great leaders are always humble. But that humility is not the humility of a Buddha, not of a Lao Tse. That humility is false. When you are no one, then to be humble is very difficult. When you are defeated, then to be humble is very difficult. Because the ego is so much hurt. It needs food. It is hungry. When you have won, you are victorious. You are on the wave, reaching higher and higher. You can bow down. Because everybody knows without saying that who you are. There is no need for you to declare it. The whole world knows it already. Then you can bow down and be humble. Kings are more humble than beggars. And then people think, what beautiful persons are these kings, these leaders. Nothing is beautiful. You can see their real face when they are defeated, never before. Then to be humble is very, very difficult. When the whole life is humiliating, then to be humble is difficult. When everybody appreciates and everybody cheers you, then you can bow down with a smiling face. There is no need for you to claim. It is already established. This has been my experience with people. If somebody comes to me, if he has already arrived somewhere in the life, he is always humble. He bows down deep. He sits on the floor. He is established. This humbleness is good for his ego. Whenever somebody comes who is frustrated, who has gambled and lost, is nobody, then it is hard for him to sit on the floor. One man wrote a letter to me that I can come and see you only if I also have a chair. Otherwise, I will not come. I know this man is very, very defeated, humiliated by life. He cannot bow. He cannot surrender. He cannot be humble. He is so humiliated that it has become a wound. Now, humility looks like humiliation. But both are in the same boat. One is defeated. One feels hurt. One feels that he has to stand. He has to claim. He has to fight for it. Another is established. There is no fight. He already knows. It happened. Henry Ford came to England once. On the airport, he inquired about the cheapest hostel in the London. And the man recognized, because just the other day there were pictures in the newspapers that Henry Ford is coming. So he said, if I don't forget, if I remember well, you looked me to be Henry Ford. But you are dressed so shabbily. Your coat looks so old, rotten. And why you are inquiring about the cheapest hotel? Henry Ford said, whether I have a new coat or old, I am Henry Ford and everybody knows about it. That makes no difference. I am Henry Ford, whether the coat is old or new makes no difference. The man said, and I know well that when your sons come, They asked for the costliest hotel. Henry Ford laughed and said, "They are still not established." And they feel insecure. They are known as sons of Henry Ford. They are nothing by themselves. I am something by myself. So the cheapest hotel won't make any difference. A rich man need not declare that he is rich. A poor man always declares. Richer you grow, the less declaration. Have you observed it in life? Everywhere it happens. An ugly woman will have more ornaments. A beautiful woman need not. The more a country becomes beautiful, the more women are beautiful, things drop by and by. There is no need for ornaments and gold. By themselves, they are enough. But an ugly woman cannot afford that. She has to carry many, many ornaments, diamonds, rubies, because only through those ornaments she is somebody, otherwise not. This happens in all the dimensions of life. But both are on the same boat. This Prime Minister was a very humble man, but fame, power, wealth and success could not distract him from his keen interest and devotion to Buddhism. Regarding himself as a plain and humble devoted Buddhist, he often visited his favorite Zen master to study under him. This too has to be understood. But fame, power, wealth and success could not distract him from his keen interest. They never distract anybody. It is difficult to be devoted to religion when you are poor, a failure. It is very, very easy when you are a success to have keen interest into religion. Because those who succeed in this life, if they reach to the top, and this man is a prime minister, he has reached to the top, there is nowhere else to go now. Now he will take keen interest in meditation, religion, God. Because a man like Kuvataje, a prime minister, a hero, has to possess God also. A man so successful has to succeed in the other world also. That's why whenever a country becomes rich, affluent, immediately a keen interest into religion arises. Now, nowhere else in the world is so much keen interest in religion as in America. It has to be so. If you ask poor Indians that why so many Westerners come to India, they simply think them crazy. There is nothing here. I am here in Pune. How many people you see here from Pune? Not a single one that you can recognize. They are simply wondering why you madmen have come from the West to listen to me. You must have gone crazy, or I must have hypnotized you. Something is wrong. They need not bother even to come and listen and to see whether something is wrong or not. They are already convinced of it. Why? They are not rich. They are not successful. They are not established. When you succeed, then you would like to succeed in the other world also. when you fail in this world, you struggle to succeed herein, in this materialist world first. So this is my understanding, that only a rich country can be religious. Poor countries can never be religious. Sometimes poor persons can be religious, because individuals can be exceptions, but masses never. Sometimes it happens, a poor person becomes religious and achieves to the ultimate, a Nanak, a Kabir, a Jesus. But ordinarily, masses cannot afford to be religious unless they are established. Religion is the last luxury. And I am saying it not in any condemnatory tone. It is so. You have to afford it. And when everything you have got and you feel you have nothing, then for the first time a keen interest arises to seek the unknown. He and the Zen master seemed to get along very well. The fact that he was the prime minister seemed to have no influence on their association. There was no noticeable trace of politeness on the Zen master's part, or of vain loftiness on the part of the minister. The association seemed to be a purely religious one of a revered master and an obedient disciple. But this is only on the surface. Deep down, the prime minister is the prime minister. Deep down, he is somebody very, very important. Deep down, he has the same ego as everybody else. This situation, this appearance on the surface, it just is skin deep. To find the reality, you will have to go a little deeper. The prime minister may have been fooled, but the master is not fooled by it. Others may have been fooled. They may have thought, what great man this prime minister is. So humble. Comes and sits at the feet of the master. So religious. Rare to find such a man. But the master is not fooled by the appearance. Appearance means nothing. The real thing is that which is deeper. And this prime minister is a polished man. He has succeeded with the world. Now he is trying to succeed with this master also, with his polished mannerism. But you cannot deceive a master. If you can deceive a master, he is not a master at all. One day, however, when he was paying his usual visit to the Zen master, he asked the following question. Your reverence, how does Buddhism explain egotism? Deep down, you cannot really befool yourself also. How can you? You know what you are doing. While you are deceiving, then too you know that you are deceiving. You can deceive the whole world. How can you deceive yourself? It is impossible. You may not be alert, but the moment you become alert, you know what you have been doing. This too is a deception. He doesn't ask a direct question. He doesn't say that I am an egotist. So master, tell me what to do about it. These cunning people always ask indirect questions. I know many of them. One man came to me and he said, one of my friends is important. what to do. And I could see that this man is important. But he is talking about his friend. So I told him, why didn't you send the friend? He could have told me that one of my friends is important. What about it? What to do? Why you troubled to come? Your friend could have come and told me the same. Then he became disturbed. People talk indirectly, and problems are personal, and they talk philosophy. They ask questions, how in Buddhism egotism is explained? What nonsense! What it has to do with Buddhism? Egotism is your problem. Why make it indirect? If you make it indirect, you will miss. You will not be able to understand, because from the very beginning you are deceiving. And you may be thinking that you are asking about Buddhism and egotism. And then a theory can be given to you, a hypothesis, a philosophy, a system. But that won't help, because each individual has his own problem. And each individual has his own problem in a unique way. If you ask, I am an egoist, what to do about it? My answer will be different. If you ask what Buddhism says, the answer will be different. Because Buddhism, then it becomes a generalized thing. And no individual is a general thing. Every individual is so much individual, authentically individual, unique, that you cannot help an individual by a general theory. No, it will not suit. If every individual needs direct approach, never ask a philosophical question. It is useless. Just ask a personal question. Just ask directly. And that's what the master has to do with this prime minister. He has to bring him down from the peaks of Buddhism to the reality of his own being. Because those peaks don't belong to you. That is not your problem really. People come to me, they say, they ask whether God exists or not. What you are going to do with God? Leave him to himself? What you are going to do? If he exists, what you will do? If he doesn't exist, what you will do? It looks like your mind is not facing real problems and avoiding them through imaginary problems. God is an imaginary problem to you. Anger, ego, sex, passion, hate, they are real problems. You don't ask about them. You ask about God. How you are concerned with God? There is no relationship. I see people who believe in God and people who don't believe in God. I don't see any difference. Can you detect a man that he is an atheist just by looking at his behavior? Nothing. How can you know that this man believes in God and that man doesn't believe in God? They both behave the same way. If you insult, they both will get angry. What is the difference? If you hurt their egos, they both will get mad. So where God comes in? This is a trick. You want to avoid real problems. The word God, moksha, truth, they are like blankets. You cover all the problems in them and hide them. They are not problems, they are blankets. And those who answer them, they help to avoid you, the reality. Your reverence, how does Buddhism explain egotism? The Zen master's face suddenly turned blue, and in an extremely haughty and contemptuous manner, he said to the premier, "What are you saying, you numbskull? Everything has changed immediately now. The master beautifully has brought the prime minister to the reality, to the earth. Just by a single word, you numbskull. A single word can do that miracles. Because you are not aware, that's why. Otherwise, the premier would have laughed. And he would have said, yes, you are right. Now, what about Buddhism, how it explains egotism? But just a single word. How much you are addicted with words. A single word, and the whole situation changes. And what is a word? Just a sound, with no meaning really, because meaning is just a contract between the society, between people, that we will mean this by this. It is just a social contract. What numbskull means? Nothing. Just a sound. If you don't understand English, what it means? Nothing. Just a sound. If you understand English, then there is trouble. Somebody calling you numbskull. Immediately, the philosophy disappears and reality comes up. All mannerism was skin deep. Your reverence, all skin deep. He was bowing down and saying, your reverence. What type of reverence is this which a single word can destroy? Skillful are Zen masters. What are you saying, you numbskull? This unreasonable and unexpected defiance so hurt the feelings of the minister that a slight and sullen expression of anger began to show on his face. Yes, it is unreasonable and unexpected. Masters are unreasonable and unexpected. You cannot predict them. They are like the wind, or like the clouds moving the sky. Where they are going, nobody can say, because they don't follow any map. They simply go wherever the wind moves. They have no goals. They have no direction. They simply live in the moment. You cannot say what a master is going to do. Never. A master is unpredictable because he is not planned for the future. He is not prepared in any way. He moves in the moment, looks at the situation, and responds. A master never reacts, he responds. A man who is aware never reacts, he responds, you react. Try to understand the difference. Reaction is a deep-rooted habit. Response is not a habit. It is a alive sensitivity to the moment. Response is real, reaction is always unreal. Somebody insults you and you react. Reaction means the insult, and what you do between these two, there is not a single moment of awareness. You react through the habit as you have reacted in the past. Situation is totally different. Somebody insults you on the street, and then a master insults you. Situations are totally different. Somebody insulting on the street just like you is a totally different situation. And then a master, a Buddha, insults you. He insults in a totally different way. He is creating a situation. He is giving you a chance not to react, not to follow the old pattern of habits, not to move and behave like a robot, but become alert and aware. If this man was a little alert, a little aware, a little mindful, he would have laughed. He would have bowed down and touched the feet of the master. Because a master insults you only when there is deep love and compassion. Otherwise, what is the use? A master insults you to show you something. A master can get angry in some moments, but he is not angry. It is part of his compassion. Just the other day, one sannyasin said to me that he has been in contact with the Gurdjieff group, and there seems to be no compassion in that system, he said. He is right. Gurdjieff was so deeply compassionate, he never showed it. He was very ferocious. Even Zen masters cannot beat him. But if you could tolerate him a little, if you could be with him in spite of him, then by and by you will feel what deep compassion he has. And it is only because of deep compassion that he is so hard. Because he knows with you, compassion won't help. Your hearts have gone so dead. They have become stony. Much hard work is needed. If one is simply kind to you, he will not be able to change you. He has to be very hard. But if you can be a little aware and live a man like Gurdjieff around him, in his presence for a few days, by and by you will see the inner core. One of the most deepest persons, deep in compassion, love, but he has become hard through experience, that if he shows compassion from the beginning, you think you are allowed to have your weaknesses. You think you are allowed to remain as you are. You think there is no need for any transformation. His compassion becomes a food for your weaknesses. No, that won't do. When a master insults or becomes angry, don't judge by ordinary standards. Don't judge by your ordinary experience. Wait a little and don't react. The Prime Minister reacted immediately. This unreasonable and unexpected defiance so hurt the feelings of the minister that a slight and sullen expression of anger began to show on his face. He must have been really a polished man. Even anger is coming, but very slightly. It is not exploding. He must have suppressed him very, very deeply. He was a cultured man, really cultured. But even to that cultured man, just a small word, numbskull, a sullen expression and a slight anger started to show on his face. Now the situation is real. A master is there without any ego. And the prime minister is there. Now the ego is showing up. Now the real has surfaced. The Zen master then smiled and said, "Your Excellency, this is egotism. And it has nothing to do with Buddhism. It has to do something with you." The master is really skillful. He created such a situation by just using a single word. Once it happened, a press reporter came to see Gurdjieff. And you cannot find more numbskulls than press reporters. They are the most surface people. They have to be, because newspaper exists on the surface. Gurdjieff looked at the man, then looked at one woman who was sitting just by the side, a disciple, and he asked the woman what day it is today. She said, "Saturday." Gurdjieff became suddenly angry and said, "How it is possible? Yesterday was Friday, so how today it can be Saturday, you fool?" The woman was shocked. Has he gone suddenly mad? And the reporter simply left. Then Gurdjieff laughed. What a way to get rid of numbskulls. And he said that if this person cannot see the point of my being unreasonable and mad, he will not be able to understand what I am doing here. It will be impossible, because it is without reason. It is unreasonable. It is irrational. And you cannot sort it out through the head. If he cannot wait, if he judges so immediately, then he will not be able to judge what I am doing here. So it is better to get rid of him in the very beginning. You live through reason. And whenever you see something irrational, you immediately make a judgment. Immediately, that is a reaction. Otherwise, there are millions of possibilities. This press reporter would have thought it may be just a joke. No need to judge. This press reporter may have thought that this man seems to be mysterious. Let us see. Wait. And the whole thing is so absurd. This Gurdjieff's assertion that how this can be Saturday, when just yesterday it was Friday. The whole thing is so absurd, there must be some deep hidden meaning in it. Wait, don't judge. But this needs awareness. And what you are going to lose if you wait. Gurdjieff created many situations, and millions of misunderstandings are still around the world rumored about him. Nobody knows what type of man he was. Nobody can know, because you try to reach through reason, and the work that a master is doing is beyond reason. It is suprarational. But to you it will look irrational, because you don't know what suprarational is. To you it will look irrational. That is because of your standpoint. The place you are standing, from where you are looking, your attitude, your prejudice, your too much addiction with reason, it will look irrational. If you follow a master, by and by you start feeling it is not irrational, it is suprarational. It is not rational that is right, but it is not irrational either. It may not look rational to you, but when your quality of being changes, then a new vision, a new clarity, a new perceptiveness happens to you, and then things settle in a different way. Then it starts looking to be suprarational, not irrational, but superior than reason, greater than reason, vaster than reason. But then one has to wait. And masters always try to create situations, because through situations reality surfaces. And what a beautiful thing the master said. Then the master smiled. You cannot smile immediately after anger. No. Because you are not a master. Even if you try to smile, you will feel so much tension in the lips that you will not be able to relax them. After anger, you cannot smile. Immediately, you will need time. So the anger subsides. It is said of Gurdjieff that sometimes he will create two impressions on two people in a single situation. If somebody is sitting to his right and somebody to his left, he will look at the left with such anger, and then he will look to the right with such beautiful smiling face. Then both friends will carry different interpretations. One will say, this man is dangerous, looks like a murderer. And other will say, I have never seen such a gentle, smiling, Buddha-like face. To some, he will look like Rasputin, a Genghis Khan, a Timur Lung. To some, he will look like a Buddha, a Jesus, a Socrates. And he could create this immediately just by turning to left and right. This is possible. This is not possible for you, because you react. When you react, you are a victim. You are possessed by the emotion. You are not a master. When you don't react, you simply create a situation. The master looked angry, condemning. When he insulted the Prime Minister, and when the insult has done the work and the real Prime Minister has surfaced, he smiled and said, Your Excellency, this is egotism. Enough for today.